ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid. It's the panel show about the things we believe. And if you believe one person can change the world, then Religious Rebels is the God Forbid special series for you. Each week we've been profiling women and men who've changed the lives of millions. The mystics who took on the mullahs, the prophets who challenged the popes. Some lived to see the change, others paid for it with their life. Like Tahiri, the 19th century pioneering feminist from Iran. She's revered by millions, yet largely unknown. In the 1800s, before a gathering of imams, all men, she ripped off her veil. It so shocked the audience, one of the men is said to have slit his throat in response. Who was this remarkable woman? Well, we'll meet three women, also Persian, to answer that question. But before we get to her story, let me give you the shortest of histories of Islam in Persia, today's Iran. In the 7th century, Muslims believe the Prophet Muhammad received his first revelation from God in a cave near Mecca in today's Saudi Arabia. So powerful was his message that the armies of Muhammad swept beyond Arabia to conquer Persia. There, within decades of Muhammad's death, Zoroastrianism had been the dominant religion. But there were also Christians, Jews, even Buddhists. But after the Arab conquest of Persia, something amazing happened. Over centuries, both the conquered and the conquerors were transformed in one of history's great cultural fusions. The Arabian military victory was swift, but religious conversion, intermarriage, and cultural enmeshment with Persia was slow, and Persians ended up enriching Islam just as they were shaped by the faith. For nearly 1,000 years in today's Iran, the dominant religion was Sunni Islam. That was the religion of the rulers of Persia too, from the Samanids to the Ghaznavids, from the Seljuks to the Turkmen. Even the Mongol Empire eventually became Sunni Muslim when they ran Iran. But in 1501, the Safavids came from Azerbaijan. They were an obscure mystic order of Sufis, a religious brotherhood that became a conquering dynasty, fanatically devoted to what's called Twelver Shia Islam. Twelver Shiites were Muslim, but unlike Sunnis, who believed religious leaders should be chosen by experts and agreement, the Shia say this is a cosmic betrayal. Only Ali, the prophet's cousin and son-in-law, and his descendants have the divine authority to guide the faithful. For 12 Shias, spiritual leadership passed through these 12 sacred imams, the 12th of whom mysteriously vanished, hidden by God himself, they believe, until his return for the end times. And these end times were believed to be imminent in Persia, Iran, in the 1800s, the time of the religious rebel we're profiling today, Tahiri, the female poet and mystic. And this is where it gets really interesting, because in 1844, a young merchant declared he was the Bab, the herald of the hidden imam. The Bab and his followers, or Babis, believed the long-awaited messianic age had arrived. From this, another religion, the Baha'i faith, would emerge. But not before Babs were persecuted and martyred, not least the religious rebel Tahiri. The only woman among the Bab's disciples, she was a poet and a learned Muslim scholar in her own right, but she cast off her veil and changed an empire. And to meet her, we meet three living Persian scholars, all crossing to us from the United States. Nega Motahedeh, Raya Hazini, and Zara Mobaleh, thank you all so much for coming on the show. I wonder if I can begin with a personal question. You are all important members of this amazing Iranian diaspora that makes such a contribution to the United States and, of course, Australia. You'll know we have nearly 100,000 Persian Muslims and Christians and Jews and Baha'is in Australia. Interestingly, we have the number of Iranians in Australia with no religion is just as high as the general population. But to each of you first, why do you make your work in history so relevant and relatable and contestable to the present, to things that are happening in the world today? Nega, to you first.
Why do I make it interesting to the present? I don't know that I went into it thinking in those terms. I was interested in the figure of Quratul Ayn Tahereh when I went in to do my PhD, and I became interested in what it meant to look at this figure and her unveiling in Iran in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, from using different modes of storytelling or history telling. So I became interested in the concept of history itself and how different methods of storytelling in history address this figure and her unveiling in the mid-19th century.
Because she, Tahereh, famously and in a revolutionary way, took off her veil, and that led to a change that is with us still. And yet you find the voices, the lost voices of women, you might say, not just in the 19th century, but in the modern 20th century and beyond. I'm thinking of literally finding women's voices, the so-called whisper tapes of the Iranian Revolution, when the Ayatollah overthrew the Shah in 1979. Yes? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Whisper Tapes is a book which returns to Kate Millett, the American feminist's trip to Iran in March of 1979. So just after the fall of the Shah, the return of the leader of the Iranian Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, from his exile in Paris. So Kate Millett, the American feminist, was invited amongst other foreign feminists to Iran to come and celebrate International Women's Day. It was the first International Women's Day to be held in a very long time. And she was the only foreign guest to arrive. She wrote a book called Going to Iran, which was based on her own cassette recordings, you know, which she whispered her observations about Iranian women and their movement and so forth into these tapes. And she wrote a book called Going to Iran based on those. I happened to find these tapes in the Duke University archives and started listening to them and realized that what I was hearing her say, what I was hearing her observe, Kate Millett observe, was sometimes different from what was being said and what was being observed by the Iranian men and women around her, the men and women who were revolting at the time, specifically attending marches around the university area and around Freedom Square, what is now called Freedom Square, about mandatory veiling. So in a sense, the history of Tahereh Quratul Ayn is very directly, and her unveiling is very directly related to this moment of revolutionary fervor in Iran in 1979 and the women's women's march and protest against Khomeini's mandate for women in government offices to wear the full-length veil.
And as we'll learn this hour, there is a direct connection between this 19th century woman, Tahireh, the 20th century women you speak of in the months after the Iranian Revolution, and now in the 21st century, the protest movement, I think in its seventh year in Iran, against the compulsory veiling of women. So Raya, to you now, tell me about the relationship of the past and present for you. It's personal, isn't it? Your family has an epic religious story in its own right.
Yeah. So my great-great-grandfather was one of the first Jewish Baha'is to be martyred. His name was Musa.
One of the first Jewish Baha'is to be martyred.
Yes. Yeah, so we have a tablet for him from Abdu'l-Bahá, the son of the prophet, founder of the Baha'i faith. Really, so, you know, all my life, my grandmother would chant the tablet to us and tell us the stories of her grandfather that she never got to meet from her mother. And then I'm a fifth generation Baha'i. And so our stories that we were told, there, my mom brought in Tahereh. As far as I can remember, Tahereh has been in my life as a figure, a religious figure of somehow overcoming obstacles, fighting through what's right, what she wants, what women need in this life. So, yeah. So, and then how is it relevant today? Well, as a historian and working on my PhD right now at the GTU, I am looking at the women in the history. This path started really with my academic, with one of my dear friends having a child and naming her Sumaya, and me asking, why did you name her Sumaya? And then finding out that she's the first martyr in Islam and going, why don't we know her name in history? Why isn't the world know her name? And so what we do today is going to be history tomorrow, right? So we always have to make our mark and make sure we write it down correctly and we document it correctly.
And to you, Zahra, this, as a Muslim, as a scholar of Islam, is crucial to you, isn't it? Because you unearth, you reveal the countless untold stories and narratives and interpretations affecting women in that faith.
Yes, and thank you for this question. It's thought-provoking. And I think that all of us carry history on our backs, each of us in one way or another. We are the continuations of the past. And what matters is which part of that past we choose to highlight. And I think that Tahereh saw history exactly in this way. And I believe that we are still continuing the same history today. I was in Iran during the whole years that women's movement were going forward. I was there. And many of the women who participated, the young generation who participated in the movement, they may not have known the name of Tahereh or her story, but that collective memory, the image of going beyond these restrictive boundaries, was a value that has stayed alive in all of us. And this is the meaning of history for me and maybe to many of the Iranian women who are not historians, but who carry on this history with them.
Isn't that interesting, Zahra? She is considered a heretic, an apostate, because of her move away from Shia Islam by the Orthodox clerical leadership of today's Iran. Therefore, her name is suppressed or whispered. And yet, even though it may not be remembered, her legacy survives still. I mean, you speak about how history lives with us, whether we know it or not. I'm thinking of your childhood, where you grew up in the horrific Iran-Iraq war. Tell me about what you call the two gods in your life, the masculine God you heard on radio and TV versus the very intimate God of your scared and grieving family as you sheltered in the bunker.
Oh, yes. Thank you for this question. I really think that I was born and grown up, and many of my generation with at least two different images of God or many different images of God. There were gods inside home, very immanent God, a very concrete God who was living with us, who I call her with feminine pronouns because she was with us living. She had emotions. She was very afraid of what were happening during the war. But outside our homes, outside the embrace of our mothers, there was another God, the God who was mostly established in the media, and he was a transcendent God. I used masculine pronouns for that God, because he was like more a father or a patriarch that ordered or commanded for doing them, for continuing this war from both sides, you know. Both sides were Shi'i countries, and both sides believed that they are the right side. So I was born and bred in this contrast between two or many different images of God. And I think still in Iran, there are these different theological structures living within homes, what I can call as urban or domestic theologies. And I think these domestic theologies are more powerful than the political theology that is being always preached in the media, in the education system. And that was these domestic theologies that gave our women and young girls the power and the self-confidence to fight for their rights.
Mm. Well, on ABC Radio National, we are looking at religious rebels. This week, Tahira, the amazing pioneering 19th century rebel from Iran. We'll hear more of her story up next. In the 1800s, religion in Iran was complex. On the one hand, it was rigid. Shia Islam was the official state religion, controlled by a hierarchical clergy. Orthodoxy was demanded. Heterodoxy was punished. But it was also a time of religious creativity. Mysticism abounded, and many believed they were living in the end times, where the Mahdi returns to begin the process of restoring justice to the world, kind of like a Shia Muslim version of the second coming of Christ. This was also the time of this woman of whom I speak, the woman who came to be known as Tahira, the Pure One. She was a poet, a debater, a theologian, a legal scholar, and ultimately a follower of the messianic Babi sect of Shia Islam. Soraya, Tahira wasn't her name at birth. Tell me about her upbringing.
Oh, so yes, her given name is Fatima Borghani, like most firstborn daughters. She gets the name of the daughter of the prophet, Fatima. And she was in a privileged household. Her father ran a school. Her father and her uncles were the second generation from the Adabat for the ulama. So they were clerics. And her uncle became Friday mosque reciter. So she lived in this town, and it's northeast. It was actually the Qajar capital.
But she was clearly exceptional from an early age, yeah? And treated as such by her dad.
Correct. But, you know, her mom was also educated and was teaching at the school as well in the women's section. So, I mean, it's said in the Dawnbreakers, which is the Babi history book, one of them, that if she was a boy, she would be his successor. That's how much talent he saw within her. But because she is a woman, that she will never have that opportunity. But she wasn't told that she couldn't study. And I say this in my thesis, that I think that comes from because his scholarship was on the Holy Family, and he knew that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his family, that he loved his daughter, Fatima. And the bloodline for all the imams has to come through her womb as well, and generations, of course. And she's not the only one. I'm going to say that in Iran at this time, or Persia at this time, the wealthy, those that had the money and the wealth, could send their daughters to school. But usually they only had the, you know, elementary level education, where Tahere, so it's Fatima, she has many nicknames throughout her childhood, like Golden Crown, for instance, would be one, and stuff. And so, but nobody told her she couldn't do school, right? Even when she got to a point where she was like, I need more, dad, or I'm paraphrasing, but he put her behind a screen in a class because she was at that level and could keep going. And because there wasn't any in that level in the girl section, she had to be behind a screen.
And eventually she became so learned, the teaching went in the other direction. She would teach the men Islamic jurisprudence from behind a screen.
Yes, she actually, you know, her dad said, you can't speak, but he misspoke, and she corrected. And it says it didn't say much, but her siblings, her cousins, everybody said they didn't mess with her, because if they were trying to work on something, if they were like in, you know, they're working on some type of commentary on the Quran, and there's a part in the Dawnbreakers that says that all of a sudden the boys are having this debate, and she comes up and says, no, you guys are wrong, it's this. And they were, because she was so precise and had intellect, like you said earlier, she was a theologian before the term was even coined for women, but she was a theologian of her time. And I think it all stems back to her historical understanding and her education on the Holy Family.
And Nagar, this was a time when it was sinful for a man to look even at the shadow cast by a woman who was not a member of his family. And yet, Tahereh, this amazing woman, was celebrated as a theologian, a poet, a scholar. What did this mean in the political, religious, cultural environment she grew up in?
She was an outstanding woman. She was looked upon as beautiful, as, you know, exceptionally smart. And I think you bring up a really important issue that to have, to be a man and to witness this woman bareheaded without a veil, right, was something that stained him in a way. In my own work, I talk about the historical moment in which she lived as an unpresentable moment. What she represented, what the Babis represented, had never been seen before. It was not something that one was present to, but it was also unpresentable in that her figure was something that could not be looked at, right? She was unpresentable precisely because she was not veiled. But also the man himself, the man who looked upon her, could not be presentable either. So this is what makes the history of this moment so interesting. How do you tell a history of a moment that you can't speak of, that will stain you, and that no one has actually ever seen before? It's so unprecedented that no one's ever seen before, doesn't know how to speak of it.
And she pretty quickly came into conflict. She was, as a teenager, forced to marry. She had children, but her intellectual endeavors, her religious ideas, clashed with her husband, and they parted ways. And this is when she had a prophetic dream. Tell me about this process.
As you were introducing Tahereh, you spoke about her as a messianic figure. And, you know, in a sense, she is living in an age where there is an expectation of the coming of the Messiah, the return in 12er Shi'ism, which was the current form of Islam in Iran, the 12th Imam went into hiding at a very young age. And the moment of his return was expected at this time in the 1840s in Iran. So he was to come back out of hiding. And the expectation was that he would right all wrongs, all past wrongs. So the Bab claimed to be, the Bab actually means gate in Arabic. And so he claimed to be the gate leading to this messianic figure, the one who was expected.
And Tara, she has a dream, yes, in which she sees a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad who makes a recitation. She wakes, she writes down what she dreamt, and then later comes across a book of the Bab where, according to the story, she finds the same words written, and at this point becomes a devout follower. Indeed, a disciple, a female disciple, yes?
Yes, she was counted amongst the first 18 to believe in the Bab and without ever seeing him or meeting him.
Zahra, what did this mean in the time? This was Iran of the 1800s, a time of British and Russian empires. Iran was ruled by the Qajar dynasty, who weren't Iranians, but Turkmen from the north. How did this shape events?
As you mentioned, Tahira, she lived in Iran in 19th century, and the official religion was Shiism, but not any Shiism. It was the Safavid interpretation, which was a state religion. That was the Safavid interpretation of Shiism. And it continued to the Qajar period. And in a family like the family of Tahira, that religion was very strictly practiced. But at the same time, that Shiism had another esoteric and mystical dimension, which was the main interest of Tahira, that there is a relationship between the esoteric Shiism and political Sharia in shaping the outlook of Tahira. Because after many centuries of this state-enforced uniform religion or Shiism, Iran became very fertile for alternative readings and new schools of religious thought by all of those many different parts and foreign neighbors who came into Iran. And the Sheikhi school was one of these different schools of thought. It emphasized the concept of walaya, which means spiritual authority, and the presence of the hidden imam. In mystical Shiism, it is even more important than prophecy. So the wali is the human being who most fully reflects the divine, is the complete human being. And in Shi'i tradition, there are many hadith or historical reports about Fatima's superiority over the male imams because she is their mother. And because of that, she is seen as the source of walaya. She has been envisioned as the reason for creation. And sometimes Fatima is being called as the mother of her father because the origin of this hadith is about her care for the Prophet Muhammad, who was her father. But in Shi'i tradition, it became a very feminine core for understanding the divine authority. And Tahira was very beautifully able to grasp these ideas of walaya and the feminine interpretation of walaya. And she wanted to manifest herself as a new manifestation of Fatima, the core of that divine authority. I think she maybe was the first one who could catch that very mystical core of Shiism, this feminine mystical core of Shiism, and tried to represent that core in her embodiment as an embodied person.
And as you can imagine, claiming the mantle of Fatima in Islam will make you both revered and reviled. We'll learn more about this on God Forbid Up next. It is our special series on religious rebels. This week, the story of the 19th century Persian mystic Tahereh, the revered figure in the Baha'i faith, also the beloved poet across the Persian-speaking world. We're with Nega Motahedeh, the acclaimed cultural critic and literature professor from Duke University, Raya Hazini, who's a doctoral candidate at Graduate Theological Union, and Zara Mobaleh, visiting assistant professor at Harvard Divinity School. In 1848, in the tiny Iranian village of Bardasht, a conference of Babis was held. They were the followers of Bab, who claimed to be the manifestation of God, following on from Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. Babs believed his revelation would release the creative energies needed to establish unity and equality across the world, peace between all peoples, men and women alike. But they had to work out how to free the Bab. You see, he was imprisoned for his beliefs. And they also had to work out how to determine the relationship between his teachings and the Islamic Shia Sharia law that existed at the time. Well, Raya, this was a small event in a small village, but ultimately very important. Tell me more.
Yeah, so just set up the event. They were in this hamlet called Bardasht, and they're by a river.
Have you been there, by the way?
No, I'm unfortunately cannot. I'm a child of, I was born during the revolution, so here in the U.S. So the circumstances leading to this conference, you had Tahereh being told to go back to her home, to her family, and her brothers and caravan is taking her home. They get back to Qazvin, and in Qazvin, her uncle is killed. Her uncle slash father-in-law was killed in the mosque, and they blame the Babi movement. So they started rounding up all the Babis and martyring them, and then Tahereh went into house arrest at her father's house, who we know as Baha'u'llah today, had in Tehran sent a couple to go free her and take her to Bardasht. So she has had a wild ride of being not necessarily like physically had a wild ride as much as an emotional and mental wild ride on this journey. And then she gets to Bardasht, she's the only woman there out of the 81 attendees.
And Naga, tell me about this life-defining moment when she speaks before these men, uncovered, takes off her veil. What was the impact of it?
Well, it's said that some people looked away. Some people cut his throat.
He cut his throat because he was so affronted that he himself had been stained by the revealing of a woman, not his family member?
I suppose. One can only suppose, when we don't know why he did, but there was a lot of tumult and a lot of disagreement about what had just happened in that scene. And many historians give many different interpretations of that moment.
Why did she do it? That's a complex question.
It's a very complex question. I believe that it was a piece of theater.
Wow. That's not uncontroversial.
No, but...
Well, I mean, because everyone claims it as their own. I mean, Baha'is... say it was the precursor to becoming a true martyr for the faith. Western liberal feminists say it was an example of, you know, I don't know, early liberalism. Even Marxists say she was a proto-communist revolutionary. You know, she, that moment of taking off the veil, it meant different things for different people, and we can only imagine what it meant for her.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But you have to understand that at this time, like, she's corresponding with the Bab who's in exile, right? And in prison. And men, the Babis, other Babis are actually questioning her leadership because, you know, and like, well, who is she? Why is she doing this? And the Bab says, you know, listen to her. You know, he gives her the title. Baha'u'llah gives her the title at Badash, but it comes through the Bab. Like, the Bab confirmed that title of Tahereh.
And Raya, did she and do you see the veil itself as the tool and symbol of her oppression? Or is it oppression done through the veil?
No, so you have to go back. So my methodology is global feminist theology, and you go into the time and setting of the place that you're looking at. So I'm looking at 19th century Iran, where all women are veiled. All women have the same, in a sense, of protocol and have to stay in the inner side of the house, not, you know, and stuff like that. So I don't see it as I would never say that the veil is a suppression. I think it's again, I have a feminist look at it, and I say if the woman wants to wear a hijab, then she has the right to wear a hijab. It's only when it's forced upon and not wanted. So it wasn't the hijab, it was the face covering veil, right? So they had the hijab and the face covering veil. And she came in without the face covering veil. And I think this is the theological aspect of where the Babi tradition stops being the 12 Shia tradition and becomes its own independent tradition. And it comes with her using the Quranic passages to announce, because all these people that are in this conference have a learned background because they're making these decisions.
And Zahra, is this the point when this group of men and one woman transition to a new religious age, an end of the Islamic dispensation?
Yes. And I think this choosing of unveiling, removing her face veil by Tahira was a symbolic gesture, I think. And it's very much related to the decision that Bab and Tahira had made before to say that, okay, the old law, the old Islamic law must be annulled, must be finished. And now we need a new law. And before the formation of the new Sharia or the new religion, we need to push aside whatever that belongs to that old law. And for Tahira, she could announce any other Islamic Sharia law. For example, she could say, okay, after this, you do not need to say your daily prayers, or you do not need to be fast in Ramadan, for example. But she expressed that theological claim that we need to break down with the old law, the Islamic law, through an act that was bound to shock. She could anticipate that shock by unveiling before an audience of all of them were men, as much as we know, and maybe Tahira was the only woman at the gathering of Badash. So she knew that the reactions would be very harsh and shocking, but she chose this act deliberately, maybe to dramatize the end of the old law, the Islamic law, through her own body, which was the most accessible thing to her. And maybe she wanted to say that as a woman. So I think it was a very symbolic gesture.
And Nega, how do you compare her unveiling, what is it now, 170 odd years ago, to the modern movement known as the Girls of Revolution Street protests, the anti-compulsory hijab movement that's been going on in Iran for 7 years now?
Well, I think that women unveil at different moments for different reasons. Tahereh saw herself as the trumpet blast, the one who would usher in the coming of a new age in religious history.
She used those words, didn't she?
She did. And the Quranic verse that was read, well, it is said that the Quranic verse that was read at the time of her unveiling was that announcement that she is the trumpet blast.
So, Raya, what happened then? She faced house arrest. She was persecuted. The Babi followers made this failed assassination attempt on the Shah. And then thousands were rounded up, the men publicly tortured and executed. What was her fate?
Well, she was part of that fate. After the failed attempt of the assassination of the Shah, she was already in house arrest in the governor's in Tehran, in the governor's the jail next to the governor's house, and so she was there for a year, and she was hosting parties with the governor's wife. Like, she was a magnetic personality. Like, if she had a personality that, you know, and she spoke elegantly, so women loved to listen to her. But after the failed assassination, the Shah actually asked for her hand in marriage, and she declined. And then shortly after that, September 15th, 1852, when she was martyred, and it was in night, because the killing of the men during the day, it's very gruesome and detailed in the history, but they wouldn't do that to women during the day. So her martyrdom came at night. And actually, she was prepared for it, and she was wearing a dress and perfume and scarf. And she told the governor's wife that, you know, let your son come with me so that nothing happens to me when the guards come and get me. And they eventually came and got her and was taken to a garden. And she asked to have her scarf be the weapon of choice. And they strangled her with her scarf. And then they dropped her in a hole. And the son sit back, the governor's son just stood back and watched and just made sure that her body didn't get desecrated after the martyrdom.
And do we know her final words?
You can kill me, but you won't emancipate women, you know, or something.
You won't stop the emancipation of women.
Women, yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah. And those are words that, you know, she said, we don't actually know those are her last words.
So Zahra, what was her great crime? Was it refusing the Shah's hand of marriage? Was it renouncing Sharia law? Was it her political defiance?
Maybe all of them were the reasons for they decided to kill her, and many Babis had been killed before her. So she knew that death was coming, and she still refused the Shah's proposal and refused to recant from her ideas and beliefs. And I think that the fact that she was executed in secret is part of her symbolic life. Her death became symbolic because she became silenced. Literally, she was suffocated, as Raya mentioned. It represents the suppression of a woman's voice. Perhaps what her enemies feared most was not her body or her family, but her voice, that a woman was speaking publicly, and with that voice, she was challenging the religious orders and the political order as well. So this is how I see this secret killing of her.
Raya, what did it mean that she was killed in secret, in silence, in this way? On one level, it means she's perhaps not as known as she could be. On another level, as a Baha'i, I imagine it makes her martyrdom all the more profound for your faith.
Oh, true. Yes. I mean, she was definitely martyred because this is a personal claim for her stepping outside of societal norms of that time. Because, I mean, there was so many times she wanted to debate, like she did her cousins and her brothers and, you know, other sheikhs, and they would put fatwas on her. And she had multiple fatwas, like, that get her out of, like, Karbala. And, like, the rebel rousing as we were calling it, is just she's standing up for her what she understands within her faith. I mean, my dissertation is looking at Fatima al-Zahra, the prophet's daughter, and Tahereh. You know, there's a lot of similarities between these two women, and I feel that there's something more. She was enlightened, and the Bab and Baha'u'llah, I think, knew that because they worked with her very closely.
Zahra, what do you think about this idea of her complex legacy? Is she a feminist? Is she a reformer? Is she a theologian? Is she, in the modern terms, like a Marxist revolutionary?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question and a complicated one. Not because we are not sure about the definitions of terms like feminist or Marxist or theologian, but because of the very complicated figure of Tahereh herself. For me, she has two different faces, the lived face and the textual face or the theoretical face. In her life, the practical life, she was one of the most extraordinary examples of what we might call now as a feminist or activist. Maybe she was one of the most courageous women in her era or of any era. She studied at the highest level. She taught publicly for men and women, and she left her husband and children to pursue her intellectual and spiritual journey. She chose divine knowledge and spiritual freedom over conventions, and she fought for this liberation and the event of unveiling, which is more famous, and we talked about it. This is the Tahereh of action or real life. But when we go to her writings, she speaks not in terms of women's rights or offers any explicitly feminist reading of Islam or Babism. In her letters, she often reproduces traditional Islamic discourse that there is a transcendent Father God who rules over all. And for example, in her letter to Bob, she has written in a very devotional style toward Bob, and she calls Bob as her Lord and her Master, the language of servitude and kingship, which is the dominant language in these texts. So we cannot expect her to sound like a 21st century feminist, but if we only had her writings, we might never have given her the title of a feminist or a womanist. So her writings are somehow separate or different from what her symbolic life shows or performs.
Well, a question just to wrap up about this fascinating woman. Firstly, to you, Negar Motahedeh, if she were alive today, Tahereh, what would she be saying? What would she be doing, do you think?
I think that she would be looking to the freedom of all. And in that sense, I would definitely say that her focus wouldn't be singularly on women. She would want to lift the burden of a regulation, people saying what you should and shouldn't do. She would want to lift that burden from the shoulders of all.
And Raya Hazini, you agree?
Yeah, I think Tahereh, if she was alive today, would have a lot to say to us about what we're doing wrong, or give us a lot of hope. But she definitely would have a lot to say about equity among all humanity.
Last word to you, Zahra Mobaleh.
Yeah, what is more striking about her life is her courage and self-confidence. I don't know if she was living here, what she would do, but I'm sure that she would be very, very self-confident about her belief. This is what is very inspiring about her character. What sustained her was faith, her inner vision of a woman as a spiritual leader. And that image, that inner image of womanhood, I think, is what truly shaped her courage and lightened her path to go forward, even while she knew that she would be killed, she would be murdered.
Well, with that, we have reached the end of God Forbid, a special series we're doing on religious revolutionaries this week, the amazing 19th century Persian woman Tahira. Thank you to our guests very much indeed. Nega Motahedeh, thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
She's a cultural critic, professor of literature at Duke University, author of some 5 books on Iran. Raya Hazini, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Raya at the Graduate Theological Union, a doctoral candidate there. Her thesis from her master's on the role of women in the emergence of Babi and Baha'i religions. Zahra Mobale, thank you, Zahra.
My pleasure to be part of this conversation.
And Zahra, her doctorate from Tehran University, now visiting professor of women's studies and Islam at Harvard Divinity School. She's recognized in Iran and the US for her groundbreaking work. Look, this is God Forbid on ABC Radio National. I'm James Carlton. It's our special series on religious rebels. All the details are on the God Forbid website. And do let me quickly tell you, I'm very excited about an upcoming episode in a couple of weeks from now. Our religious rebel will be Malcolm X, the African-American revolutionary who rebelled against the Nation of Islam and paid for it with his life. Though it's a story still being told because 2 of the men found guilty of the assassination of X were exonerated just 2 years ago. After being wrongly jailed for more than 20 years, it rewrote the official history of one of the most notorious murders of the civil rights era. But unlike the assassinated contemporary of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X did not turn the other cheek, and he certainly didn't love his enemies. Instead, X urged African Americans and black people around the world, for that matter, to fight back in self-defense wherever and whenever they are unjustly and unlawfully attacked. Have a listen.
And you and I live in a country which is supposed to be the citadel of education, freedom, justice, democracy, and all of those other pretty sounding words. We want freedom by any means necessary. We want justice by any means necessary. We want equality by any means necessary. We don't feel that in 1964, living in a country that is supposedly based upon freedom and supposedly the leader of the free world, we don't think that we should have to sit around and wait for some segregationist congressmen and senators and a president from Texas in Washington, D.C. to make up their mind that our people are due now some degree of civil rights. No, we want it now, or we don't think anybody should have it.
Malcolm X's famous "by any means necessary" speech. Less than a year after he made that, he was shot dead, with the FBI and the CIA, as well as the Nation of Islam, all alleged to be involved. But if they sought to silence him, they failed. Malcolm X's influence today is arguably greater than when he was even alive. And to discuss his legacy, we have 2 very special guests. One, a man who, just like Malcolm X, grew up around crime and ended up in prison, but like Malcolm X, used his years behind bars to turn his life around and is now a professor of Malcolm X studies. The other guest, Malcolm X's Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer. That episode drops on the 28th of November, or exactly 2 weeks from now if you're listening to the radio edition. I'm James Carlton. Until then, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.